call James Blevins.
Versus State.
May it please the court, Mr. Iadella will argue for appellant, Mr. James Suter will argue for the state.
Both ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Ms. Bella, would you like to begin?
Begin.
May it please the court?
Counsel.
Your Honor, my name is Julia Bella. I am here representing the appellant, James Blevins. And I would like to address the two points that we've raised on appeal. First is the evidence of attempted murder is legally insufficient to support his conviction. And second, that the evidence is both factually and legally insufficient to support his felony conviction for violation of a protective order. I will start with the attempted murder case. And I realize that the facts have been extensively briefed, both in my brief and in the state's brief. But the task of this court is to do as the Court of Criminal Appeals said in McCravey versus State, to draw an imaginary line between acts that are merely preparatory and those acts that would constitute an attempt. And that job requires a hard look at the facts and to look at each case and its own facts specifically. So I will go through just a few of the facts that have been basically agreed upon and were proven. On June the 13th of 2008, Mr. Blevins came to the home of his estranged wife, Amy Blevins, and found her there with a man named Jason Myers. He became upset, and he pushed past Amy Blevins to get to Mr. Myers. They had a physical fight. Mr. Blevins then left the home after telling Amy Blevins, "I'll kill you," went to his house half a mile away, and took a loaded .410 shotgun, put it in his car, at some point called his mother and said, "I'm going to kill him," and then drove the half mile back towards Amy Blevins' residence. In the meantime, Officer Rosedahl had been called. He was already at the home. He intercepted Mr. Blevins about 40 yards away from the house, where Mr. Blevins had the gun inside the car. The testimony of the officer was that Mr. Blevins did not manage to get any part of the gun out of the car. It was still inside. The barrel was pointed up and stuck against the roof of the car in the window. Now, those facts were the facts that were introduced at trial. And even conceding those facts, it is our contention that the evidence is still legally insufficient to prove that Mr. Blevins committed attempted murder.
The gun was loaded?
Yes, Your Honor, it was.
And he was trying to get it out of the window. Is that correct?
Well, the testimony was conflicting on that. Mr. Rosedahl said that Mr. Blevins was maneuvering the gun. The barrel was stuck up against the top of the window. He believed that he was trying to get it out of the car. Mr. Blevins testified during the punishment phase that he was not trying to get the barrel out of the car. It was across his lap, and so there was no movement to try and get the barrel out of the car and point it. And he was 40 yards away from the house at the time, down a long driveway from the house, where Amy Blevins was standing in the front yard of the house.
Thank you. Well, you don't think that there's a difference between possessing a gun and transporting a gun to where she was?
I believe that possession and transport, and this is according to several cases that we have cited in our brief, possession and transport of the weapon are not sufficient to constitute an act that goes beyond preparation. You notice that in the Bledsoe case, The gentleman involved in that case had a screwdriver and a clothes hanger, and he's sneaking around in a parking lot with apparently the intention to burglarize some automobiles. So, yes, he had possession of a screwdriver and a coat hanger, and he had also transported them to the parking lot where it is assumed that he was going to break into some cars. So he has also procured and transported a weapon, or not a weapon, but a means of committing an act against the law. This case is similar to that case in which Mr. Blevins has the means with him. He has procured it. He has transported it to the place where he would probably, where it was alleged he intended to commit a crime, but he did not take any affirmative act to actually use that weapon. The gun was not aimed or pointed or fired at Mrs. Blevins. And that is what makes this case different than some of the cases that have been decided, like Cody or Hart or Godsey, where the person involved had possession of the means to commit a crime, took it to the location where they intended to commit the crime, and then actually began to use those instruments. Like in Cody, the gasoline poured all over the balcony of the school in an attempted arson case. Or in Hart, where the gentleman had actually taken a knife and used it to inflict injuries. Or in Godsey, which I believe is the case that is quite instructive in this case, in that you have a weapon that is loaded, and the appellant in that case actually lifted the weapon, pointed it, and aimed. And all that was remaining, according to the Court of Criminal Appeals, was to pull the trigger. That case is distinguishable from this one in that Mr. Blevins never had or took the opportunity to actually start putting that weapon into use. There's quite a bit of discussion about intent. We're not contesting the state's proof with regard to intent, but intent alone is not sufficient to prove attempted murder. There must be intent coupled with an act more than mere preparation that tends but fails to affect the intended offense. The state in this case said that bringing the shotgun to the house is the act that drives this case beyond mere preparation. And to that end, they have cited several cases which are persuasive authority from other states, I believe California, Mississippi, and Alabama. However, on inspecting that case law, it shows that those states are using a different standard. They're saying that any overt act in furtherance of a crime, and in the Parrish case, the California court clarifies and says even slight acts where intent is well established can be enough to move past mere preparation. Our statute is not so broad. We must, to prove an attempt, the state must show an act that tends to affect the commission of a crime. And the guidance that our courts have given us to this point has been that when you have possession and transport of a weapon, that does not move you beyond mere preparation. It is putting those means to use that goes beyond mere preparation.
You say those other statutes in the other states, use the word any overt act in furtherance of?
Yes, Your Honor.
Tends to?
I believe
tends to.
The cases cited by the state Supreme Court of Mississippi, Billy Ray Ford versus the State of Mississippi, every person who shall design and endeavor to commit an offense and shall do any overt act toward the commission thereof, I believe is the statute.
Thank you.
Same with the Alabama statute. In Alabama, a person commits the crime of attempted murder if he intends to cause the death of another person and does any overt act towards the commission of that intent. And I apologize,
That's fine. That sufficiently answers my question. Okay.
But, and I think what the state is asking for in this case is to expand the interpretation of Texas's statute to where it is similar to Alabama or California or Mississippi, to where any overt act would constitute attempt. And that would be the purview of the legislature if they wish to change the language of the statute, make it a little more broad, and say we're not going to require an act that is more than preparation but that tends but fails to affect the commission of murder, then they can go back in and rewrite the statute to say any overt act. And any overt act could be going home to get the gun, or if James had been intercepted in the driveway of his house, maybe that could be considered an overt act. But as our statute stands now, it limits what can be considered more than mere preparation. And requires, according to the interpretations of the previous case law, some attempt to actually use the means of committing the offense. Our second contention is that the evidence was legally and factually insufficient to find that Mr. Blevins had committed the offense of violating a protective order in such a way that he could be convicted of a felony. The state alleged in his case that he had violated Penal Code Article 25.07, which makes it a crime to violate a protective order, and Ms. Blevins had a protective order in place. And 25.07G makes that crime a Class A misdemeanor unless the individual charged has been previously convicted twice of violating a protective order, or if they violate the protective order by committing an assault or stalking. Now, our contention is with the assault. In the indictment, the state alleged that the defendant committed assault by pushing and shoving Amy Blevins. But when she was called to testify and testified about the incident at the house, she denied that assault had caused her any bodily injury. She said that she did not feel pain. Now, there are three definitions of assault. First, causing bodily injury. Second, with intentionally or knowingly threatening to cause bodily injury. Or offensive or provocative contact that intentionally or knowingly causing offensive or provocative contact. It is our contention that when the legislature intended to create a felony for violating protective order, that they meant assault to mean bodily injury, assault. And we support that with the idea that that is a felony level conviction, punishable by 2 to 10 years in prison. These other types of assault are Class C misdemeanors. When the legislature created enhancements for assault crimes against family members, they did not create enhancements for the Class C level assaults. It only becomes a felony if you commit an assault by causing bodily injury, physical pain, impairment, or illness. And it is more consistent with that legislative intent to interpret assault in Section 25.07G to mean only an assault that causes bodily injury. And I'm running out of time, so I just want to go into the last point We also believe that the evidence was factually insufficient to believe that even if assault does include offensive or provocative contact, there was no evidence to show that the defendant intentionally or knowingly caused that offensive contact. He pushed Amy Blevins by to get to Jason Myers. He did not intentionally or knowingly push Amy Blevins to cause her offensive or provocative contact. There was no evidence submitted at the trial to prove otherwise. And if that is the case, then they have not proved an assault that would make James Blevins' violation of protective order rise to the level of a felony. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Brasher, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir. May it please the court? Counsel? Your Honors, I believe this court should affirm the finding that appellant did enact amounting more than mere preparation that tended but failed to affect the commission of this offense because his intent to kill was clearly established. His actions went well beyond mere possession of weapons, and when all the evidence is viewed in the light most favorable to the verdict and the prosecution, a rational juror could find the elements proven beyond a reasonable doubt. The appellant clearly expressed his intent to murder Amy Blevins four times during the course of events. Ms. Bella stated that they do not dispute that fact. However, the severity of the intent strengthens the fact that his actions went well beyond simple or mere preparation. And I think the timing of the threats has a lot to do with this also. The first threat that we have was when the appellant arrived at Amy Blevins' residence when he saw Jason Myers, became angry, shoved her out of the way to attack him. At that point, Amy Blevins grabbed the phone and stated that she was going to call the police. The appellant then at this time threatened to kill her if she did call the police. Well, she went ahead and called the police anyway in his presence. As soon as she got on the phone with the police, he rushed back to his house, grabbed his weapons. Like we said, the .410 shotgun was loaded, and there was a Derringer that was capable of firing .410 shells that was under the seat. And he started to head back toward Amy Blevins' house, where he makes his second intention to murder Amy Blevins and the others. In this case, he actually called his own mother, and his mother testified for the state that he told her he had his weapons, he had his guns, and he was going to kill Amy and the others. She tried to convince him not to go to the house. He hung up on her. And the mother was so worried that she called Amy, who was with Officer Rosedahl, and told them what the appellant had just told her. I think that's important, too. He had just got done making his second death threat, and then he arrives at Amy Blevins' house. Now, the evidence in the record reflects that both Amy Blevins and Jason Myers observed the appellant with the shotgun hanging out the window when he was driving up to the house. Amy Blevins said that the shotgun was pointed out the window. Jason Myers testified that he saw the shotgun come around and out the window and that it was pointed. It's at this point that Officer Rosedahl, once they yell, tell Officer Rosedahl that the appellant is pulling up, he grabs his gun and turns and runs toward him. And the evidence is uncontroverted in the record as to guilt innocence that he was trying to get that shotgun out the window. At some point when Officer Rosedahl went out to intervene, the defendant had pulled the shotgun back in. But Officer Rosedahl's testimony, which is not disputed, is that he made several attempts to get the barrel of that gun out the window. And while he was doing that, he made more death threats. He said twice, "I'm going to kill them all, I'm going to kill them all." Amy Blevins testified to that fact. And the fourth death threat came when Mr. Blevins was taken into custody. After he was placed into custody, he was still yelling at Amy Blevins and Jason Myers, saying that he would get another gun and he was going to kill them. He would hunt them down. The death threats were very specific, not ambiguous statements. His intent was very clear, both to Amy and Officer Rosedahl, and that's important in this case also. The appellant's claim that he never took a step beyond possession of a weapon is utterly inconsistent with and unsupported by the facts in the record. The facts go well beyond mere possession of weapons or mere preparation. The line, I believe, between mere preparation and attempt here was clearly crossed. I think that line probably lay somewhere between the point where he loads his guns in his car and the actions he took next, or his next action. At the point when appellant transported the loaded shotgun, which he was holding, he didn't have it behind the seat or anything like that. He was holding this shotgun and a pistol that was under the seat. When he transported these to Amy's house, where he knew he would find her, because he had just come from there minutes before, he had, in fact, crossed that line. And Amy and Officer Rosedahl, like I said, were both aware of his second threat that he made to his mother.
Excuse me, you're saying that, in effect, his possession and transport is sufficient?
I believe so, Your Honor, but the facts, I believe that's sufficient. At that point, he's crossed the line, but our facts go even further than that also. Not only did he simply transport the weapons, he had the weapon pointed out the window when he arrived. And when Officer Rosedahl tried to intervene, he was attempting several times to get the barrel of the shotgun out the window. For whatever reason, he wasn't able to. He kept jamming it up into the top of the window. So the facts do go well beyond that. At this point, this is an act that goes toward using the weapon. I believe Ms. Bella stated that there's nothing in the record that indicates an act was taken that went toward using the weapon. This is an act. Pointing the shotgun out and attempting to point it out the window again is that act. In fact, appellant was at the second to last proximate act before the commission of murder, and that's a very important fact, and I'll speak about that more in a minute. First, I want to address the purpose of the attempt statute. And that is, the purpose of the attempt statute is to allow law enforcement to intervene to prevent the harm intended. I'm going to speak about Godsey versus State. I have a little different interpretation than Ms. Bella does about Godsey, but it is a Court of Criminal Appeals case cited in both the briefs, in which the court notes the practice commentary to the attempt statute. The court states that the intent of the attempt statute is to allow police to intervene before the defendant has come dangerously close to committing the intended crime, and allows police a reasonable margin of safety after the intent was sufficiently apparent to that officer. Well, we already know that the intent was sufficiently apparent to everybody at the scene, including Officer Rosedahl. And I do believe that this is probably the most serious type of case that this attempt statute was designed for. But for Officer Rosedahl's actions that day, Amy Blevins would be dead. Officer Rosedahl was aware of all the threats to kill. So obviously that intent was apparent to him. And like the court said, though, the intent is to allow police to intervene before the appellant has come dangerously close. Well, unfortunately, in this case, the appellant did come dangerously close to carrying out his actions. He arrived at the scene with a shotgun locked and loaded and pointing out the window. The attempt statute was designed to allow police to intervene far before this act. Unfortunately, though, in our case, that couldn't have happened. The only way that couldn't have happened is if the appellant was pulled over at some point before he arrived back at Amy Blevins' house with that shotgun. So I think the court's very clear about that this case went far beyond what the attempt statute was even designed for. Officer Rosedahl, in fact, did what we should want and what we should encourage all law enforcement officers to do, and what this attempt statute is designed for. He intervened before it was too late. The appellant must not be absolved because of Officer Rosedahl's actions, which did prevent a murder. In attempt law, like the Court of Criminal Appeals stated in Godsey, attempt law does not draw the line at the last proximate act. In that particular case, the court stated that the only act remaining to effect the commission of the offense was to actually pull the trigger and hit the target, and that the intent was not to draw a line at that last step. So the Court of Criminal Appeals clearly has a line drawn somewhere, sometime before a person can even point a weapon. And in Godsey, there weren't even specific threats to kill anybody. But in this case, we had four of them. And addressing the facts in Godsey, the Court of Criminal Appeals stated that to require a proof that the defendant fired the gun or tried to fire the gun and it misfired, or actually fired and he misses target, that would undermine the notion of attempt offenses. Well, in our case, like in Godsey, the appellant had completed that second-to-last proximate act. The only act remaining for him to effect the commission of the murder was for him to pull the trigger and hit the target. This situation fits exactly with what the Court of Criminal Appeals notion of attempt is, as stated in Godsey, and certainly no more evidence in the record, in my opinion, is required to prove attempt, and probably far less than what we actually have in this case. And if the line is not drawn at that last proximate act to prove attempt, then it follows that the second to last proximate act is per se legally sufficient to show attempt. And I do believe it's important. I know Ms. Bella talked a little bit about the four cases, two from California, one from Mississippi, and one from Alabama. But these cases have very similar fact patterns to our particular case, and it appears that their overt act standards have been applied the same way that our more than mere preparation standard has been applied. These cases are more directly on point fact-wise than are the cases that Ms. Bella used to support her particular argument. And in those cases, the gist of all four of those cases were that the defendant possessed the weapon, transported the weapon to the place where he was likely to find the victim. That's what happened here, and in fact, our case goes beyond all four of those. So the evidence in the record is legally sufficient. A rational juror could find that the elements of attempted murder were proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And if the court has no questions about attempt for me, I'm going to move on to the violation of protective order. The court should affirm the finding that the appellant committed a felony violation of the protective order because the felony violation of a protective order by assault does not require proof of bodily injury according to the statute. And the evidence is legally and factually sufficient because there's no dispute in the record or in the brief that the state proved what it had alleged. And what it had alleged was that an assault was committed. Section 25.07G, Ms. Bella talked a little bit about that. It does not require proof of bodily injury. That particular penal code section deliberately states an assault. It does not state an assault causing bodily injury. The statute is not ambiguous. And since it's not ambiguous, it requires that it be interpreted literally, unless doing so would cause an absurd result. Well, there's nothing absurd about the result of construing that statute literally in this case. The legislature intended to make violation of protective order by committing assault a felony, and that's logical. If one has done enough acts to have a court enter a protective order against that particular person, then it's only logical to think that if you're going to commit another act, an act of assault, no matter what type of assault, all types of assault are physically violent crimes, it's only logical then to ramp up the prosecution by violating that protective order in another violent way. And the legislature, in fact, wanted to differentiate between an assault of violating protective order by assault versus violating that protective order by simply driving within three city blocks of the applicant of the protective order. So that is certainly logical that any form of assault, as it states in the statute, is what the legislature intended. And the legislature, under 2201A1, expressly made bodily injury an element of that particular subsection of the statute. Well, the legislature writes all the statutes, and they did not make that an element of 2507G, and that was deliberate. And the punishment range for a third-degree felony of 2 to 10 years is also available to take into account the severity of the assault which led to the violation of protective order, whether there was bodily injury, and if so, how much there was, or if there's not. That's why we have ranges of punishment for certain degrees of offenses. I do believe it's important to discuss two cases from other Texas appellate courts that go directly to this issue. The first case is Matthews versus State. It's an Amarillo Court of Appeals case from 2009. And in this case, the state did not specify the manner of assault in its indictment for violation of protective order, felony version. But the court in that case held that so long as the evidence shows the commission of an assault, which includes offensive physical contact type of assault that we're dealing here, then that assault will support the conviction, the felony conviction of violation of protective order. Robertson versus State is another case that I believe is very persuasive and instructive as to our case. That's a Houston Court of Appeals case from 2005. Appellant in Robertson contended that the state did not prove that the box cutter was a deadly weapon. They had alleged in their indictment for violation of protective order, they used the second definition of assault, which is the threat of imminent bodily injury, and they alleged that that was by a box cutter, which was a deadly weapon. Well, the court in Robertson held that deadly weapon is not a statutory element of 2507 for violating a protective order. Likewise, bodily injury is not a statutory element for violating a protective order because, just like deadly weapon, it does not appear in 2507G. It's not in the statute. And in fact, without the deadly weapon finding, which the court stated is not necessary, then the underlying threat there is another Class C form of assault. So that particular court was using a Class C form of assault to uphold the felony conviction of violation of protective order. That's the same situation we have here. We just have the other Class C type of assault. And the state did prove what it had alleged in the indictment. I don't think anybody can state, and there was no testimony to it, that the appellant, oh, I'm sorry, can I finish my point, please? There was no testimony that the appellant didn't know he was pushing Ms. Blevins aside when he was going to attack Jason Myers. It's reasonable that if you're going through somebody to get to somebody else, you know you have to push him away. So the evidence is legally and factually sufficient, and this finding should be affirmed. Thank you for your time.
Your Honor, I wanted to refocus just a minute. We've talked a lot about, both the state's attorney and I have talked quite a bit about, you know, whether or not the weapon was pointed. And I want to make sure that I clarify that in the indictment that charged Mr. Blevins with attempted murder, the act alleged was whether or not he possessed a shotgun and transported it to the home of Amy Blevins. That is what the conviction is based on. Whether or not the weapon was pointed is extra. We contend and can still contend that weapon was not pointed, but what the state chose to charge was Mr. Blevins committed an act that was more than preparation that tended to affect the commission of the offense by procuring and transporting that shotgun over to Ms. Blevins' house. And since that's what we're focused on, since that's what the indictment is, then that's what needs to be focused on when we determine whether or not that act is sufficient to be more than mere preparation. I want to also make clear to the court that we are not asking the court to go back and overrule the precedent to say that you cannot commit an attempt unless you have committed the last proximate act to committing the offense of murder. What we would ask the court to do is to take a look at this case in its own facts and draw that line in where it's consistent with the other case law. And that is with case law like Bledsoe and Gibbons, where possession and procurement and transport of the means of committing an offense is preparatory. And I'm concerned that I'm going to become redundant if I keep talking. So are there any questions that I can answer?
No.
Thank you very much.
That concludes this case, and the case is submitted. We will let you know when our opinion is issued. Thank you very much for driving down here, and have a safe trip back. And I'm sorry I referred to you as Mr. Brasher,
okay.
Mr. Souter. I'm sorry. Court is dismissed.
Thank you.
All rise.